Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Our laws, Peter, are very clear. Our laws dictate that a citizen can protect him or herself. The only cap that is there is that you can only protect yourself with equal force as the aggressor.
A Zambian parliamentarian repeats his call for opposition supporters to protect themselves from attacks by partisans of the governing party.
We call upon everyone for the renegotiation of the second part of this transition to have a government of unity with an agenda within 1 year to hand over the power to the civilian government.
The leader of the Guinean opposition Liberal Bloc Party calls for the renegotiation of the transition to expedite the return to constitutional rule.
So he started that project. As for now, he has installed 38 CCTV cameras.
And the Sierra Leone police begin the installation of CCTV cameras across the capital, Freetown. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Binwell Mpundu, a Zambian parliamentarian, repeated his call on opposition supporters to protect themselves from attacks by partisans of the governing United Party for National Development, or UPND. The legislator was released after his arrest by the police for an article on his Facebook page in which he called on opposition supporters to practice self-defense. But the police charged Mpundu with sedition. In a press statement, the police contend that the action of the lawmaker incited members of the public and politicians to acquire firearms for self-defense. The police deemed the call prejudicial to public order. But parliamentarian Binwell Mpundu tells me that his arrest was politically motivated. He adds that the constitution enables citizens to defend themselves against aggressors.
I was arrested and charged with a crime called seditious practices. Now, you wish to know that this is a crime that used to be very common back in colonial days, when colonial masters basically used to keep Africans shut, particularly Zambians shut, from talking. So it looks like this is something the UPND have picked, such that anyone who speaks today will be slapped with this charge, basically to keep people silent from holding this government accountable.
Some people are saying that you were charged with sedition because you called on opposition people to defend themselves from violence and attacks by the UPND cadets by arming themselves. That is where the problem comes from, that you said they should arm themselves, which could create instability and tensions in Zambia.
Peter, you may have read a report in the last by-election that was held in Kawambwa. Opposition political leaders were attacked right at the police station. The police could do nothing. Okay, so my call was very simple. Now that we see that the police cannot protect us, because if we are going to be attacked right in the presence of the police, one thing remains very clear, that we are on our own, because the role of the police is to guarantee us our safety.
I was going to ask whether the Zambian constitution allows for your call on Zambians to defend themselves when the police are also mandated by the constitution to maintain law and order to protect civilians.
Our laws, Peter, are very clear. Our laws dictate that a citizen can protect him or herself. The only cap that is there is that you can only protect yourself with equal force as the aggressor. Meaning that if the aggressor comes with a knife, it will be justifiable for you to use a knife to defend yourself. Now, the next issue which you have alluded to is my call that my fellow politicians now must buy guns in readiness to protect themselves. The question would be, is it wrong to own a gun in Zambia? Do the laws of Zambia allow citizens to own guns? The law in Zambia, Peter, provides for citizens to legally acquire guns. Now, the catch is, my call was, let us get ready to defend ourselves. What should be the worry of the state? The worry of the state should be the aggression, because you cannot defend yourself if there is no aggression. If I was asking people to attack others, then there would be call for alarm. But I was asking people to get ready. And my statement is very clear. Get ready to start defending yourselves. Because you will not defend yourself, Peter, if there's nobody who is attacking you. So I'm basically saying, can we now be alert to be ready to defend ourselves?
But people are suggesting that as a member of parliament, you have certain privileges, and you could have approached the high-ranking top police officials, including the Inspector General of Police, to raise your concerns about the need to protect every Zambian, and that by calling on Zambians to arm themselves, to protect themselves, is a violation of the law.
Peter, how many times have we called on the police to be impartial? These attacks are not starting today. They're worse now, because previously, people would assume we were basically making mere, allegations. This particular incident, Peter, happened right at a police station. And if you listen to the story of President Sean Tembo, the police were actually chasing Sean Tembo away from the police station. So if you ask me, why didn't we go to the police officers? These are calls that we've made for a countless number of times. So it only remains that we can only call on our supporters to start getting ready to start defending themselves.
Where is your case now, or what is next in your case?
Well, they've released me on police bond. They charged me. So obviously, when they do their investigations, they will obviously be pushing the matter to court. Now, I want to tell you that there are over 100 cases of seditious practices before the police and before the courts as we speak. There are over 100 cases of hate speech on the opposition as we speak.
Binwell Mpundu is a Zambian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Botswana, the Southern African Council of NGOs is calling on former president in the region to help resolve political tensions in Mozambique. The group, which represents civil society groups in the Southern African region, is also calling for the end of all activities that could inflame tensions. This after Daniel Chapo was sworn in as president of Mozambique. He succeeds Philip Nyusi, who has completed the maximum 2 presidential term limits. The call comes after the group expressed concern about the violence following the October 9 presidential election last year. Human rights groups say at least 278 people have been reported dead and many others injured due to the post-election violence. For more about calls to help ease the political tensions, I reach Moses Nkandiwiri. He is a leading member of the Southern African Council of NGOs.
We are very much concerned with the violence that has taken place in Mozambique over the way elections were conducted. And we feel that a number of people, women, children, they are suffering. Much property has been destroyed. A number of individuals have been internally displaced as well as externally. And then we're saying, look, the best way for us is to ensure that there is peace in Mozambique. And in addition to that, what we've done is that we have set up a community of elders involving former heads of state, like from Malawi, Botswana, Tanzania, as well as South Africa. And we're quite happy with the leadership of these former heads of state that they would want to work to ensure that peace comes back in Mozambique.
As part of the proposal to end these tensions, what key proposals is the organization making at this point?
At this point, one of the key amongst many proposals is that Would have loved if the leadership in Mozambique would have postponed inauguration of the president so that there has to be dialogue between and amongst the different, you know, parties to the conflict mediated by these individuals that I've mentioned.
What else? Because talks called for by former President Nyusi to ease political tensions seem not to have worked. So do you think your proposal will resolve these issues?
It is our intention, honestly. We know that tensions will always be there, but for the sake of Mozambican people and the Mozambican nation, it's extremely important that we should be able to listen to each other within Mozambique, but also outside of Mozambique. Because you know what? Lack of peace in Mozambique has got far-reaching consequences even within the region in Southern Africa. Those are the concerns. And that's why we have even engaged the former heads of state to ensure that they do talk to the leadership in Mozambique, both the opposition as well as those who are in the ruling parties.
But see, the issue is that there are concerns about how the elections were organized, what they claim to be rigging and voter irregularities, which led to the election of President Chapo, who was just sworn in, is the key reason why they are displeased with the situation. How do you think this can be resolved with some of these proposals you are making?
Yeah, that's why we're saying there has to be dialogue and for us to understand, and also the leadership that were put in place to understand the nitty-gritties that have actually led to this kind or escalated, you know, into a stalemate. So it's extremely important that we have to gather as much information as possible for the leadership that were put in place to make proper, you know, decisions, but also to mediate properly between the conflicting parties. So at this juncture, it might be difficult to go deeper into looking at those critical issues up until we are in Mozambique and we see what challenges are there.
Talking about engagement of broader Mozambican societal leadership, what does this mean?
What we're saying is that, you see, it's extremely important that the leadership, again, of the civil society in Mozambique, the religious leaders, traditional leaders, the women-led organizations, youth, and everybody has to participate in this kind of a dialogue. I think it's extremely important so that nobody is actually left behind, and that the leadership of the conflicting parties, both those who are in opposition as well as in ruling party, they should be able to share where did they go wrong? How were the elections managed? Are the elections just a trigger of the bigger picture of the issues that have been simmering underground? We need to find out, and from there we can then design a long-term peace-building kind of program to ensure that peace comes to normalcy in Mozambique.
What has been the responses so far since your engagement with the former leaders in the Southern African region to help mediate the anticipated talks that you seek?
We are extremely happy because each leader that we've talked to in South Africa, in Malawi, as well as in Tanzania and Botswana, they have all accepted, they have appreciated, and they're the ones who are basically championing this kind of an initiative so that peace comes back to normalcy in Mozambique.
Moses Nkandiwire is a leading member of the Southern African Council of NGOs. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
In Guinea, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party is calling for the renegotiation of the transition to expedite the return of constitutional rule to the West African country. This after an opposition coalition known as the Force Vives announced its withdrawal from the National Transitional Council. It cited the failure of the military government to meet a key deadline for a return to democracy. Civil society and opposition groups, including the Liberal Bloc Party, criticized the New Year's message where military leader Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya stated that a referendum for a new constitution will be carried out, but without giving a date. Critics say his announcement is a ploy to hang on to power and to delay the democracy process. Faya Milimino, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, tells me that his group is proposing a civilian-led unity government with a one-year mandate to lead the process to organize elections to end military rule.
We call
call upon everyone for the renegotiation of the second part of this transition to have a government of unity with an agenda within 1 year to hand over the power to the civilian government. But since we made that call, we are not seeing any move, neither from the government, the junta, nor from some other opposition party. And now, part of the opposition is in the process of not recognizing the institutions. For we waited until the 15th of January. Since the government is not moving toward organizing a dialogue to renegotiate the second part of the constitution, we are about to decide not to recognize any transitional institution anymore.
But fire, supporters of the military government says the military leader has outlined the transition period this year, and that what you are calling for and other opposition parties are calling for contravenes or sharply opposes what the military junta has put out this year.
I mean, the reason why it is hard to believe in what the junta is now saying is that everyone can remember that when the junta came to power, the chief of the junta had said it clearly that after the transition, neither himself nor junta members or the government will be candidate for any office. But since the last 4 months, what we have been hearing is they are trying to promote the candidacy of the chief of the junta, which is very dangerous in this country, because
those are mere rumors. He has not come out, his supporters say, to fully
say that he will be running. We cannot call it as just the rumors, because you have the member of the government. One of them is the spokesperson of the presidential palace, going around the country using public equipment, cars, and so on, using public money, asking people to support the candidacy of the general, is no longer just a rumor. Yes, he has not said something about it yet. But given that all those things that his government members are doing, they cannot be doing it without him accepting them to do it, because by doing it, they are using public money. Instead of using that money to organize elections, they are using money to create movements, associations to support the candidates. It's no longer to support even the agenda of the transition, but to support the candidacy. That's why people not believing anymore what they're saying. The second reason, at the end of 2023, the junta president had said that in 2024, we will at least have a referendum. We didn't have it. How come, without any dialogue, taking us to an accord and putting in place a government of unity with an agenda, who can believe what is going to happen again in 2025? We may see the same thing that we went through in 2024, and the country is getting in deep in the nightmare.
So, Faya, if opposition groups, including yours, decide not to recognize the transitional institutions, then what happens next? What's the significance of that?
It's going to be, unfortunately, the chaos in the country, because, look, it is a republic. It is not a monarchy here in Guinea. It is a republic.
Faya Milimino is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry.
Join the Voice of America on January 20th for comprehensive coverage of the presidential inauguration ceremonies as President-elect Donald John Trump takes the oath of office. From live reporting to expert analysis, VOA brings you every moment as history unfolds. Stay informed, stay connected, only on the Voice of America.
The deputy spokesperson of the Sierra Leone police says the installation of closed circuit television or CCTV cameras across the capital of Freetown will help officers to carry out their constitutional mandate to maintain law and order. Bob Sinsenu also says that the move aims to boost public safety and enable law enforcement efforts to combat crime. This after the police started installing CCTV cameras in strategic parts of the city, including high traffic areas and known crime hotspots. The footage, the police say, will be compiled as evidence in criminal inquiries. Deputy Police Spokesperson Bob Sinsenu tells me the installation of the cameras demonstrates the commitment of the Inspector General of Police to boost the security infrastructure and public safety.
This has been a project since 2014, but the project was never implemented, the Smart City project. So when the Inspector General of Police assumed leadership, it was a bitter moment wherein we experienced the August 8, 9, 10, 2022, six police officers were killed, and also civilians. So he decided to say, no, we have to look at technology to put our eyes at strategic locations, and this can be done through the CCTV camera. So he started that project. As for now, he has installed 38 CCTV cameras. Not only in Freetown here, we have a major checkpoint called My 38, which serve as a gateway to Freetown. We also have the control room, where we have police officers who are detailed to monitor the movement, free flow of traffic, as well as some of these criminal-related activities at strategic areas. And then this was also how we are able to police the festive season. You know, moving again from the Freetown West, we also decided to capture Freetown East, which is also another busy areas. We look at key areas where we think these are vulnerable points for criminal activities. Also area that we think it is more prudent to have our eyes there. So this is just a mere project, a good initiative done by the Inspector General of Police to ensure that police visibilities are fed at some of those areas.
How will this camera facilitate round-the-clock monitoring in crime detection and prevention? Talk to me about that.
Basically, with the help of this camera, we're talking about the 2023 fake coup. We are able to capture some of those fugitives. Some of those fugitives we are able to identify through the use of this CCTV camera. So it helps the police to carry out our investigations. And then we are doing thorough monitoring on this one. It records, for instance, if we had to investigate incident within the Freetown East, within these locations, we just go to our control rooms and look at all details from this period to this period. So that also helps to aid our investigation. And then we are also not only aiding the police investigations, but also to guide the behavior of police personnel who are also deployed at strategic locations. For instance, like my 38, we monitor their conduct on the 24-hour basis. We also look at proper supervision, what they do in terms of executing their duty. So it's a win-win situation. Police officers are aware that they are now under surveillance camera. They do exactly what requires them to do. And also aid police investigations when it comes to dealing with criminal-related activities.
Will this also help in how police carry out their duties across Freetown, particularly when it comes to transparency during investigations?
Indeed. For instance, if we, when the fake coup incident occurred, November 26, 2023, people were denying it was not a coup. But those were saying that most of those guys are not even in Freetown. But when we started retrieving some of those informations from the camera, it was a clear evidence. Nobody denied. So basically, the IGP decided to say, we want to extend this one also to other part of the city. So basically, this is also another project. And they also have intention to replicate these ones to the provinces, like bigger cities like Bo, Kenema, Makini, you know. So it's a very big initiative.
Bob Sinsenu is the deputy spokesperson of the Sierra Leone Police. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Nigeria, over 65 civil society groups and human rights activists are expressing concern about what they say is the harassment and intimidation of Amnesty International. In a jointly signed statement, the groups called on the government to stop the Nigerian police from taking legal action against Amnesty International. It comes after the police threatened to take legal action if the organization fails to retract and apologize for its report that accused the police of using excessive force and abusing the human rights of citizens during last August's nationwide protest called End Bad Governance. The police issued a seven-day ultimatum to retract and apologize. Failure to do so would lead the police to take legal action. Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He tells me that actions of the police will not deter human rights defenders from demanding the respect for the fundamental human rights of citizens.
So this is coming as a result of the continuing shrinking civil space in Nigeria. Harassment, intimidation, bullying. That is why civil society organizations came together to demand that the security should stop bullying, attacking, harassing, arresting, intimidating civil society organizations who are simply calling on the government to respect the right of Nigerians to do things according to the law and order we have in the country. Even the president himself acknowledged that there was loss of lives in Kano, Borno, Kaduna, Jigawa, and Kaduna. And, you know, he, in his second speech, said that there will be a committee to investigate all the police and other security agents that were involved in killing and also in arresting and detaining, as well as maltreating kids, that without participation of the general public or at least people that can give evidence on what happened, for them to come and be attacking Amnesty International for simply re-echoing what other organizations, including government agencies like Human Rights Commission, has actually, you know, said, because they said that 28 people were killed. So this is a call that we will continue to do as a civil society, and it's better for the government to respect the rights of the citizens and, you know, do things according to the law and order.
Some critics are saying the Amnesty International report should have gotten a feedback from the police about their report, and that the failure to cross-check the fact, they said, undermines even the credibility of Amnesty International in Nigeria.
The police can say whatever they want to say, but the Nigerian people, they know what happened. And if police have carried out their own investigation without involving anybody, I don't know why they think that, you know, an independent organization must involve them in what they are doing. You know, but it is a very clear evidence that the government itself, through the National Human Rights Commission, have confirmed the killing. And also the president of Nigeria had acknowledged the killing and the loss of, you know, lives and properties, and that he said that action is going to be taken to punish those police officers who were involved. So I don't know how the police spokesperson will now come and write or undermine the president.
But you know, the police spokesperson
denies sharply the report that suggests that human rights violations occurred during the protest and that they just maintained law and order as enshrined in the Constitution.
Everybody saw it was on television, on Arise News TV, on Channels TV, everywhere people were seeing how some of those police, you know, officers were shooting, brutalizing the citizens. So it's not something that anybody will take them seriously. In fact, this kind of people, they are actually not supposed to be image maker of the police. And I think it is important that they call such kind of people, you know, to order, because they are further creating a terrible reputation for the Nigerian police.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion that the plans by the police, including the ultimatum, could further undermine civil society groups' efforts to call on security institutions to respect human rights in Nigeria?
We have numerous problems and challenges, and the police want to use its energy and time and effort on things that you cannot deny, no matter how much you want to deny what you have done, you know, because the public have witnessed it. Amnesty do not just sit down to confirm what even Human Rights Commission, National Human Rights Commission has done, and other newspapers that have reported this killing, but went to even the families of these victims to speak to them about what happened. So the report is detailed, is very comprehensive, and it follows all the necessary due process. And if the police want to deny it, they can continue to deny it. But the president of Nigeria had actually recognized that something wrong had happened by the police, and that is why he said that there will be investigation, there will be a committee that will investigate those police officers and those other security officers involved in maltreating and even detaining the minors in Nigeria. So I don't understand what police is trying to do. Are they trying to say that Mr. President of Nigeria is lying? Or are they saying the National Human Rights Commission is lying? Or are they saying Nigerian newspaper journalists that have covered this brutality, you know, they are lying? Or are they saying that the parents of these children that were killed are liars?
Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the Executive Director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In South Sudan, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the ICRC, says medical doctors from the group continue to treat wounded patients needing medical assistance due to the ongoing conflict in Sudan. This after the ICRC deployed a mobile surgical team in Renk in South Sudan's Upper Nile State to treat the influx of refugees fleeing the Sudan conflict. Cecilia Going, a spokesperson for the ICRC in South Sudan, says over 230 wounded patients fleeing Sudan have been treated in 1 month. It also comes as South Sudan faces a cholera outbreak. For more on the ongoing medical assistance by the ICRC, I raised Cecilia Going in the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
The ICRC deployed a mobile surgical team to Renk in Upper Nile State. And the main objective of sending this team was to provide medical assistance to all the influx of weapon-wounded patients. So this is the main reason. So since the deployment to Renk, the team was able to, or they conducted over 250 surgeries on different kinds of patients. So we are carrying out this mission in partnership with Doctors Without Borders. Because what the experts of the ICRC, the medical staff of the ICRC, what they are doing, they undertake the surgeries while Doctors Without Borders are taking over with post-surgical surgery care. Sorry,
Celia, I understand the concern is that apart from this influx, South Sudan is also experiencing a cholera outbreak.
Yes, on top of the situation, yeah. So in that sense, we are supporting the South Sudanese Red Cross. We are supplying safe drinking water as well as promoting hygiene practices to the population, to the communities. Also, you see, the cholera is also a medical emergency. So in response to this emergency, we've been working closely with the South Sudan Red Cross. It's our like relatives of our partners in South Sudan, and also with the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society. The idea is to be able to curb the spread of the disease, so providing drinkable water, which has been distributed through water tracking to those communities that are affected by the cholera.
Celia, I understand the situation on the ground is more complicated because the influx of those who have been wounded as a result of the ongoing violence in neighboring Sudan, in addition to the cholera outbreak. What is the current situation on the ground?
Well, the current situation is that as a consequence of the fighting that is taking place in Sudan, there are hundreds of thousands of people. We are talking about over 110,000 people that are crossing, have already crossed to South Sudan, and we are talking about Sudan refugees and South Sudan returnees. So this implies that, of course, for the population, it's a lot of stress. They are saving their lives and they're crossing to South Sudan. And then for the local, for the host communities, this represents a lot of pressure because there are thousands of people now arriving to them, to their communities, because they need to feel safe. So this is why people are leaving their homes. It's not because they want, it's because they need to be safe, and they leave their places where they live to other areas which are safer for their families. You know, their kids, their women, their elderly people, and they need to find a safe place to stay.
Will this process of treating these wounded people who are coming from the conflict zones continue?
Yes, for the time being, because this peak of violence started at the end of November, so just over a month ago, we sent our teams to provide medical attention, medical care to the weapon wound. For the time being, we're still there. We have our teams working, providing support to those most in need in terms of medical attention, in terms of the cholera issue as well. We have also, I think, working jointly with the South Sudan Red Cross, we have a team of people who are supporting those families who need to get in contact with those relatives who are still in Sudan. So we call this Restoring Family Link Services. This is taking place outside the hospital in Rennes. If it's okay for you, I would like to tell you that from these services I was explaining to you, in December, we managed to provide 735 calls from South Sudan, people who were in South Sudan, to their relatives in Sudan. So this is it gives you the magnitude of that, you know, families are facing, because they still have relatives in Sudan. So they need to inform them that they are safe in South Sudan, and they just also want to know how they are in Sudan.
Cecilia Going is a spokesperson for the ICRC in South Sudan. He spoke with me from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. Human Rights Watch has found that African governments continue to crack down and wrongly arrest political opponents, critics, activists, and journalists. The rights group also says armed forces and armed groups in some African countries have targeted civilians, killing them and driving them from their homes. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The conflict in Sudan and Ethiopia feature prominently in a Human Rights Watch report released Thursday. It says that in Sudan, the war between armed forces and the rebel Rapid Support Forces has displaced 12 million people, destroyed infrastructure, and blocked humanitarian assistance. In Ethiopia, rights group investigators found that government forces in the Amhara region committed widespread attacks against medical professionals, patients, and health facilities. Mosi Segun is the head of the Human Rights Watch Africa Division. She says armed conflict is not the only form of rights violation on the continent.
On top of all of that, you have all of the civic space restriction abuses, you know, including just the intolerance for freedom of expression, intolerance for freedom of association and assembly. Protests are being clamped down on, people who are pushing for their rights, you know, or to even comment on government policies and measures are being hunted down. Here in East Africa, we are seeing a very disturbing trend towards abductions.
Kenya has captured the attention of human rights groups for recent alleged abductions of anti-government protesters and activists from foreign countries. some of whom have been deported to Turkey and Uganda. The Human Rights Watch report also focuses on the seemingly endless conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where civilians are killed, women raped, and attacks on camps for the internally displaced continue to push more people into neighboring countries. Congo has accused Rwanda for supporting M23 rebels, an allegation Rwanda denies. Clementine de Monsieur, Human Rights Watch senior researcher, says the expansion of conflict worsens civilians' harm.
It's certainly a concern to see the regionalization of the conflict. We've seen in the past cycles of violence in eastern Congo and across the Great Lakes region that have had a devastating impact on civilian populations. And we're not seeing significant signs of pressure on the different parties to the conflict to reduce violations and harm to civilians.
The report notes that countries in West Africa ruled by the military, like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, have cracked down on opposition and dissent, freedom of expression, and backsliding in the fight against corruption. It knows that in southern Africa, Mozambique is grappling with post-election violence in which hundreds of people have been killed. Elizabeth Kamundia, Deputy Director of Disability Rights at Human Rights Watch, says conflict and violence are causing a rise in disabilities.
We have seen a rise in the number of people acquiring injuries that lead to disabilities. We've seen increased psychological distress and mental health impacts on people, families, communities as a result of war and conflict. We've seen difficulties with access to medication for people who have mental health conditions, and therefore they are forced to stop their treatment.
Human Rights Watch's newly released World Report reviewed human rights records of more than 100 countries, including 25 in Africa. Despite the widespread abuses and violence against people in Africa, HRW notes that, like the rest of the world, African people are resisting and pushing back against autocratic rule and abuse of their rights. It notes they are also mobilizing on social media and streets to demand an end to the abuses and bad governance that has contributed to divisions and conflict among communities. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today marks the end of my commentary on VOA that commenced in 2002. During these 22 years, I have striven to ask Africans and the supporters to remember what our founding fathers said when they created the Organization of African Unity in 1963. These were wise men with wealth of experience of the world, and they framed their goals on that basis. The first thing they said was this: the African government and people should always strive to be united and strong. They must always try to speak with one voice in international fora. They also look back at the history of Africa, particularly the Rome-Berlin Conference of 1885. And they said that to avoid the balkanization of the African continent, there should be a pledge by all African states after independence to continue to respect the frontiers and boundaries handed to them by the colonizers. That was done in 1964. And I can assure you that that pledge and its observance grievance has maintained calm because we do not have, as you have seen in Europe, fighting between African states because of boundary disputes. There are big wars, but they have been kept calm. They also advise African states to seek membership in the United Nations, which has its multilateral desires and also provides for collective security of all states, which they believe, but at least can give temporary security to all of Africa. They also ask African states to strive always to solve African problems by Africans themselves. This was the recognition of the disaster in the Congo crisis from 1960s to 1964, which caused harm to the people of the DRC, and they are feeling it today. They then turned to the question of development. They said that Africans should try to elevate poverty and develop the African economy for the betterment of the people. As you may recall, Kwame Nkrumah said to all Africans, seek you first the political kingdom, and everything else will be added to it. Now, the issue of development is problematical for Africans. Even after decades of independence, many, many Africans are still living in poverty, even though there have been some improvements. So I have tried to reflect what may be appropriate for Africa to develop. First of all, it is clear that just buying and selling will not develop Africa appropriately. Therefore, African states should commit themselves to undertake massive infrastructural development. This would mean infrastructure development with good and safe roads, infrastructure judgment in high-speed trains, evolution in air transportation to deal with the chaotic air connections in the African continent. Now, let us be frank. These are very expensive projects. And it is also time in this connection that Africans begin to end the colonization of the African mind as a takeover from colonialism. Too long have Africans sit back, planned, and then said, let's look for donor financing. That is not how to develop African culture. And it's not also necessary that one have excessive dependency on other countries for your development. It is too risky. Africa has tremendous wealth in the continent. In the past, the colonial countries take much of the resources of Africa to their own country and use those resources to develop their country and people. So Africans should make the pledge that the era where these things were done should be brought to an end, while Africans should open their hands, their minds, for those who want to use the critical resources of Africa, they should come. But it is time for them to start the process of manufacturing on African soil. This will give the platform for industrialization in Africa, which is lacking now. Only when we have industrialization can Africa be able to end poverty. Today's world, every government, whether in Africa or abroad, their first goal is to create good paying jobs. So that is only what brings about middle class and stability. So they should leverage this opportunity in Africa for those who need the rare metals and crucial measures in terms of sources for their needs. So when this is done, when Africa starts the industrialization process, it should try to avoid the mistakes of others to make sure that the wealth is spread throughout the society. Of course, they should preserve strong democratic government. But Africans should understand that the founding fathers warned them not to allow foreign bases on African soil. That was observed for a time, but with passage of time, Africans forgot about it, and they are seeing the consequences. And it's only now, in the last few months, perhaps not even a year, that African countries are beginning to say to the outside world, please remove your military bases so that we can have full exercise of our sovereignty. I hope these trends will continue. And when I talk about secularization of the African mind, there is one thing which Africans should strive to do. Forget what you were taught in school. Africa is one continent. Forget about the Sahara Desert. It doesn't mean Africa is split into two. The because there's a tendency for some Africans to make that division. So these are the ideas and messages I've tried to convey for 22 years. And I hope with a new generation of leadership in Africa, that the continent will prosper and the lives of its people will improve. And then Africa will be respected. There will be mutual respect between African countries and the outside world. So I want to wish all Africans and their friends well. Try to make Africa still important and strong. If first we succeeded in the question of development in infrastructure, as I said, in roads, in rails, air, and in ports, then maybe the dream of Cecil Rhodes that we can have a rail link from the Cape to Cairo will open up a vision to many Africans, and perhaps those who manage to get to Luxor, the Valley of the Kings, could see the wonders of Egypt, even before the introduction of industrialization in Europe. So please don't give up as we struggle. Be strong. Let me say adieu and goodbye, and wish Africa all the best. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
But tonight I'm out here with you, my baby. I love perfect timing, cause when I bless my eyes on you, not to put my mikono you daily. And let the blessings fall on me. I'm in the zone while she whine on me. Hey, give it to me, baby, so slowly. I need tired of
too much care, my dear. Waka waka wa Sunday, my dear.
Kwamarashi na huta wazamani sitaki tena yule kufa kiansi msiba
Kipita wavujena marashi mahi. The hugger smell up all on me. She liking how I ride the beat. I whisper loving in her ear slowly. Journey ku baby mgongoni baby. Huni potese girl. My baby don't you worry. Ball in my arms and twirl. My baby push it on. Cause I talk up in that way where everything would have been.
Game. Sick in the fame, no, it ain't not game. But boy, she know how to shake that thing. How to reach that thing. Gotta play that string. I play that music when the night falls. Play the record that we rock and we'll be right for. All the girls in the late night flow. We made that fall. You shake that fall.
Doesn't she know that's just what I feel?
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how intense a fire is, it is still water that will quench it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.